The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. As we head into Hour 3 on Tuesday, this Tuesday, we do so as we do every Tuesday with Hugh Hallman, former mayor of Tempe, attorney at law, educator, businessman, civic leader. Delighted to have you. Politics, principles, we're going to need them today, Hugh, and I was looking forward to your visit because there's no one I really wanted to just have a kind of a broad conversation about what transpired yesterday with than you. You have been an executive. You are an attorney. And, of course, you've been a political,
political hack?
Well, I was going to say operative, but I was worried that was pejorative. You went to hack. All right. Okay. I guess I'll ask you the same question I was asking other attorneys, and I was talking to Hans von Spakovsky in the last hour from the Heritage Foundation. What were your first thoughts last night or yesterday when you first heard about this raid at Mar-a-Lago? Just off the cuff, first thoughts.
Immediately, two thoughts, and they are in opposite directions. That I have long had faith in the FBI as sort of the honest broker in law enforcement. The quality and training that FBI agents receive, and the base from which they're recruited, has given us an array of men and women who have committed themselves to upholding the rule of law. And that's the crucial issue for the day.
And they were serious and sober.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
They were known for their seriousness and sobriety.
With respect to the enforcement of law and that we live by the rule of law. And so last night, when you contemplate the fact that the FBI has raided the home of the 45th president of the United States, that has a level of seriousness to it that I only can hope and pray that the people engaged in this activity did so with that very clear mind about the business in which they're engaged. That said, we certainly have also seen in recent years the abuse of these most important positions by people who allowed their political views to taint their actions. And certainly we saw that in the earliest days of the Trump administration, as even in the January 6th committee hearings, one saw the kinds of things that the FBI director was engaged in and drawn to with respect to President Trump. I wouldn't say it was evinced an evil mindset, but it certainly demonstrated one that was tainted by a political position and view. And this is not somebody who was viewed as a lefty liberal, but he clearly, the then director, clearly had a view of incoming President Trump that was tainted, and in large part tainted by the fact that the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton had been able to so effectively undermine his reputation as having been elected legitimately and without Russian help. Now, think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are with the continuing hearings about Donald Trump's leaving office and the January 6th hearings about the specific attack on the Capitol. I'll just speak for myself. I did not support that kind of activity, don't support that kind of activity, and my side has never supported that kind of activity.
You can speak for me on that.
And so here we are watching this taking place. Immediately, I think both of us decrying that that activity should not take place. We are about the rule of law. That's our side. And we decried the fact that during the summer of 2020, the left could, as you mentioned in your monologue, could excuse violent protests, destruction of property, burning of courthouses on the grounds that it was acceptable because it was questioning racism and attacking that. And that, in fact, one could protest and object to racism and do so without a mask or concern for COVID. That was your point in your monologue. And yet, that only applied if you were protesting racism. It could not apply to a conservative view that we could protest lockdowns or just celebrate, as you mentioned in your monologue, Easter. That it depended on which side you were promoting. And that's what's now undermining my faith and my belief and my view that we could trust this administration and an FBI being operated under the gun of this administration. And I mean that exactly how I said it, under the gun of this administration, to do so as honest brokers. And it's because I look at Mr. Comey's thinking before President Trump took office and think if that can infect the director of the FBI and how he behaved toward an incoming president, why wouldn't it now infect what they're doing today?
You know,
or yesterday?
No. Well said, and it opens up a lot of points of inquiry. Maybe the least of them, but it leads to a bigger conclusion. Maybe the least of them is this. You've represented a lot of high-profile clients over the years, and have you ever seen a situation where someone is following the law, they're not any kind of flight risk, there's no record of lawlessness, and a government agency or a local, state, or federal government entity needs to serve them a search warrant or even bring them in for questioning or even possibly arrest them, where this wouldn't be negotiated lawyer to lawyer rather than it wasn't a midnight raid, but the equivalent of a surprise raid? Have you ever seen that? I mean, we've seen it with a few people who have worked for Trump, but this is new to me. I don't remember this kind of behavior in the past. I have seen, you know, usually high-profile clients have their attorneys deal it out with the prosecutors, and it's usually not even a story.
And let us say that neither of us support the idea that people with means get a different level of treatment. And certainly the 45th president is a person of means. But the point you're making is that
it does happen with their lawyers, unfortunately, that there is that tier. But yes.
The reality is, even here locally, there was an incident in the end of 2015 in which a, quote, raid, unquote, took place in offices in Tempe and Chandler, where everything was swept out, where the principal of the company was met when he arrived on an aircraft and literally met at Sky Harbor, his briefcase taken from his hand, and his home searched at the same moment. So everything broke at the same moment, from private facilities, homes, that sort of thing. And now, a week ago Thursday, that individual was acquitted on all charges. So imagine going through 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, up to August of end of July of 2022, nearly 7 full years of the kind of scrutiny that goes on with respect to this kind of investigation, and then be acquitted. Mm-hmm. Where does one go to get one's reputation back? And this person's name was slathered across the airwaves, across the news media here, the print media, and it was a very high-profile matter. One can certainly understand that the entire weight and force of the United States has been brought to bear on the effort to gain access to the 45th president's home. That's what's so troubling here. That the amount of time and effort that would have been spent to do this. Now, certainly there is the issue of the January 6th hearings. Plenty of stuff has come out with respect to how people were behaving in the White House. Stuff that I find abhorrent, because my view is the rule of law applies and the Constitution is so meaningful that you damn well better be sure that what you're doing fits within those lines. And it is interesting that now we look back on somebody like Richard Nixon, who refused to contest the 1960 election, notwithstanding that sitting here today, we know violations occurred in Texas, violations occurred specifically in Chicago, that would have swung the outcome of that race. And that person said, Richard Nixon, of all people, said it would be too damaging to our country. that's a patriot. And I think back about the other rare times that kind of thing has occurred, and it is rare. Those are the moments of profiles of courage. Will Richard Nixon ever be regaled for having done that? Not really, except for a moment on this show. That's what has me worried. That, well, can the FBI be counted on to be the honest broker now going forward?
So, Hugh, thank you for that. Let's do this in the next segment then. Let's examine a little bit, knowing that this could have been done another way. And knowing that, you know, the range of crimes they could possibly be investigating have nowhere, as far as I've seen, been alleged in public. I don't know what crime he could actually be guilty of. The Federal Records or Presidential Records Act has never been ramped up to this kind of enforcement. Let's talk about what the possible political thinking could have been and what the possible political fallout may be when we come back. I'm Seth Leibson. He's Hugh Hallman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. If you're looking for a really remarkable and unique investment opportunity with a great return for investors, check out my friends at YRefi. What they are offering is a fixed no-load interest rate up to 10.25% return for investors, all in a secure and collateralized portfolio. YRefi is a due diligence approved firm. It's run by great people, investors doing very well by doing good for others, and you can be too. Check them out at investyrefi.com. The word invest, the letter Y, R-E-F-Y.com, or give them a call at 855-316-3087, 855-316-3087. Talking with Hugh Hallman here in studio about, obviously, the story of the day. And, Hugh, what you sketched out in the previous segment about how these things typically are done unless the Department of Justice wants to make a scene of it, wants to make a story of it, wants to maybe show their big footing of the situation and strut over what they're doing, kind of tip the scales by making a big scene of this. This is what they're doing here, when it very well could have been something negotiated between lawyers outside the sight of cameras and news media, leads me to think there had to have been a political point to this. There has to have been a political consideration in all that was involved. And in thinking about what they possibly could be thinking, do the Democrats in Washington understand? Are they reading the room, so to speak? Are they reading the national room? You have a president and leadership of the Democratic Party that is continually denouncing all Republicans with broad brushes, if not being white supremacists, then being the equivalent of Bull Connor and George Wallace. Joe Biden said the very thing this year. They just are pushing a law that came to light over the last 3 days that they want to hire 87,000 new IRS agents, but we're only going after billionaires. There aren't 1,000 billionaires in America, 87,000 IRS agents. They just passed a law in the House of Representatives to further curtail gun rights. Are they reading the room as to why Americans are becoming more and more nervous about their civil liberties, more and more nervous about the people who are supposed to be protecting the law and the Constitution? And then they go and do something like this, which looks like rogue renegade behavior, banana republic stuff. I don't think it ends well. At least I don't think it ends well unless very serious, calmer voices prevail very quickly. Am I overstating it?
No, I think that may be part of the strategy at a political level, that the goal continues to be to push the conservative side of the political universe so hard that there is an overreaction, much like what happened on January 6th. Mm-hmm. I view that as an overreaction, that activity of storming the Capitol and committing violence was no better than what occurred in the summer of 2020 by people burning down the courthouse in Portland, Oregon, or destroying downtown Los Angeles, or for that matter, Scottsdale, Arizona. And that isn't what my side stands for. And yet, at some point, even Thomas Jefferson understood that if the government behaves sufficiently badly, revolution is supposed to be the response. That is such a battle and such a high-risk game given the unique nature of the U.S. Constitution and its form of government. That's what's at stake here. And I think the folks on the left are much less concerned about losing that because their behavior is demonstrating through the kinds of words you're hearing by elected officials in Congress that the concept of totalitarianism that is wrapped in communism and socialism is acceptable, and that their side, the ends they seek to achieve, justify any means to deploy that they need to deploy to achieve them. This is not wanting to sound like a nut job, but I've spent too much time in Russia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan. And
it's beginning to look familiar, is it?
Yes, it is. And the men and women in those countries are just like we are in human. They've just been acculturated to something different. And there are still people in all three of those countries that look at Joseph Stalin as a remarkable leader.
Right.
Someone who murdered, through his actions and inactions, tens of millions of people. Murdered them. Kazakhstan is one example I give. There were 6,000 people who lived in Kazakhstan in 1920, or 6 million people in 1929. By the end of 1933, 1.5 million of them were dead. 25% of the population died at Joseph Stalin's hands because the ends, collectivization of agriculture, and the riddance of their society of the middle class, the folks who he believed were likely going to forestall the communist dream, were worth death. Imprisoning women and their and daughters of his political enemies in a special concentration camp, Alger in Kazakhstan. Almost 10,000 women and girls were imprisoned there, raped, beaten, starved, and saved by the Kazakhs who were living around them through remarkable efforts and stories that bring tears to my eyes even sitting here today. That is what happens when you push these envelopes, because the Russian people were protesting about the fact that under the Tsar's rule, prices of bread were going up and they couldn't feed themselves quite as adequately. And the communists used this as the opportunity to create revolution. And it took the Soviet Union 30 years before they got back to the point of producing the level of amount of bread that had been produced before the revolution. That's what you get. And those people caught up in the moment, like AOC and others in Congress, who think this is wonderful. And gee, the former communists and socialists, they just didn't do it right. Mm-hmm. The answer is, embedded within that philosophy is a totalitarian approach that destroys freedom, liberty, and the opportunity to speak. And madam, when your turn comes and you're looking down the barrel of a gun for saying the wrong thing, you had it coming to you. Those of us who are on the outside decrying this today are trying to prevent that result.
That's exactly right, because that's what the rule of law means. And it's an interesting thing, the rhetoric. We're going to hit a break here real quick, so let's do that. And then let's come back on the rhetoric that has been ramped up. Because, you know, you and I think it's fair to say, you can always correct me if I say something on your behalf that's not true, but you and I tend to be not just conservative in our politics, but fairly conservative about the means in achieving our politics, because we kind of view the Constitution as a matter of conservative process. And that's why most people educated and informed by the notion of a constitutional republic care about processes and care about something that it seems the Democratic Party at this point doesn't anymore, which is respect for their fellow human beings who may have opinions that differ, and the rhetoric they use to denounce us, which I think sets a stage for them to then do to us what we're seeing them do to us. If that wasn't completely clear, it will be right after the break. I'm Seth Liebson, and he's Hugh Hallman. We'll be right back. For those listening on podcast, we're coming back to the theme song from Welcome Back, Carter. Did you watch that show as a kid, Hugh?
I did, a little bit.
Yeah? Did your dad like it? Your dad was a teacher. Carter was a teacher. Gabe Kaplan?
He did not watch much television of that variety.
Right.
That wasn't dad.
You don't watch sitcoms about mayors, probably. I'm Seth Leibson.
Kelsey Grammer did a pretty good one.
Who did?
Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. He had that odd disease, too, didn't he? Lewy body syndrome or something like that?
That's right.
I need to go back and I watched an episode or two of it and then somehow got distracted. That constitutes our cultural moment on this show. Hugh Hallman and I are talking about.
Back to the show.
Yeah, back to the show. The rhetoric the Democrats use to denounce their political opponents, Hugh, I have been on this kick for some years now, that when they first talked, I noticed Hillary Clinton doing this in 2008 and 2009, they would no longer talk about Islamic radicalism, they would no longer talk about Islamic fundamentalism, they would no longer talk about Islamic terrorism. What they started saying was religious extremism. They started denouncing terrorists as religious extremists, the enemy we were fighting at the time, still fighting today. They called them religious extremists. And then I noticed when it became campaign time, they would use that extremist label to now paint Republicans. They have now created the mindset that our enemy, the threat to our national security, is an extremist. And now they are importing that word for domestic uses in their political campaigns, 2 and 4 year increments. That Paul Ryan has an extreme plan. Paul Ryan is an extremist. Mitt Romney is a dangerous extremist. From there, it only escalated to all kinds of adjectives and nouns like white supremacist, racist, threat to the Constitution, existential threat to the country. These are phrases they use to describe Republicans, people of the opposite party in America. And it seems to me this use of rhetoric cannot be accidental, in my view, and that it is deliberately used to marginalize the political opposition, in this case Republicans, beyond the pale of acceptability and respectability, such that they are now second-class citizens, tolerated or tolerable here and there, but never, never appropriate to take power, and never really even appropriate to have the same constitutional and political norms applied to them. Am I making any sense? I mean, Joe Biden has taken this to a fairly well himself. You were pointing out how he was painting Republicans as extreme MAGA ideologists only a week ago, right? So I'm just wondering if this deliberate use of rhetoric to marginalize half the country, maybe, or at least a third to half the country, isn't melding itself and revealing itself for how they plan to continue to use power against us.
Absolutely, and this is welcome to the human condition. I mentioned in the last segment that under Joseph Stalin, a quarter of the population of Kazakhstan is just one example. We most of us knew in grade school or high school, read about what happened in Ukraine. Very similar numbers. Starvation, murder at the point of a gun, all kinds of things taking place in the Soviet Union because the means were justified by the ends. This great place that would result. Now, did Joseph Stalin, Yosef, actually believe that stuff? Hard to tell. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that suggests he understood exactly what he was about. He was a totalitarian hanging on tightly to great power, to his and his family's great benefit and that of his friends. But that at any moment you could cross him and you were then going to be finding a gun pointed to the back of your head. Darkness at Noon is a novel that's describing that kind of thing for anybody who want to read it. But your point is that using this kind of language to marginalize one another, and I'm merely trying to point out that it's not about people who are of different races. It's not about people from a different country to be marginalized. Germans were marginalizing German Jews. The 1.5 million Kazakhs, the 25% of the population, weren't murdered by Russians. They were murdered by other Kazakhs. The same with the Ukrainians. They were implementing policy that had the language associated with marginalization of people who you wanted to get rid of. And first step is to marginalize them, and then the second step is to remove them from the conversation entirely. And what that ultimately results in, AOC, is that you end up as well in that same mix, because there's no longer a concept of rule of law, no longer a concept that anything goes. And when you become a problem for the system, you can be eliminated just as easily. And this society was built on an entirely different ethic, that the rule of law mattered and that each of us would be treated with respect.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think is gnawing at people in a way that they have a hard time articulating. And then it becomes, the next question becomes, well, what will happen after November? And what does this do to those who support Donald Trump's quest for running again for the presidency? Does this encourage him to run further? Does this encourage them to want him to run further? Let's pick up on the political fallout from this when we come right back. I'm Seth, he's Hugh. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman is my guest, as he is every Tuesday. Thank you for doing this, as always, Hugh, with your perspective, common sense, and wisdom.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. The psycholinguistic use in politics, the use of language to talk about friends, allies, but equally opponents, is extremely important. In 1977, Reverend Jesse Jackson wrote a piece, an essay as to why he was pro-life. He's since changed, but in those days, as so many in the civil rights movement were, he wrote an essay about being pro-life. And he was talking about the use of language in discussing your political opponents or your political objectives. And he said it came to him very personally that when he thought about slavery in America, that we didn't speak, or the enslavers or those supporting slavery didn't speak of African Americans or Black Americans as human beings or Americans. They gave them words we really don't want to say on radio and probably can't. They used the N-word and other words. They dehumanized them, took them out of the human condition. And you can see where he was going with that in the abortion debate. We no longer talk about an unborn baby. He said we call it a fetus. We take it out of the human equal protection condition so that we can thus do whatever we want to them. You could ride human beings if they weren't human beings, as horses, I suppose, or treat them as animals in the condition of slavery. You see it in the abortion debate. Once something's not a human, you could do, his point is, you could do anything you want to it. People of Jewish heritage, or anyone who studies the Holocaust, knows how well that was done. And you certainly know how it was done through the experience of Stalin's rule as well. You dehumanize your opposition, you can then do anything you want to them. And it seems like, short of that, what Joe Biden and his Democratic allies have been doing by painting us as white supremacists, as racists, as existential threats to the Constitution, that there's this notion probably taking hold at the Department of Justice, probably taking hold inside the FBI, that they are on the side of the gods. And the law that would normally protect every American doesn't necessarily have to apply to these cretins. And I just worry about this notion that there is one right answer to politics in America, and they view themselves as having all the righteousness and their opposition having none. Thus, they can do whatever they want to them. Make any sense?
It does, because we saw this beginning in 1964.
Mm, yes.
When Barry Goldwater was deemed an extremist, and the first real hit ad on television was the daisy turning into a nuclear weapon exploding. And that was the way to demonstrate that Barry Goldwater was not only not somebody you should vote for president, but somebody unfit for office.
A threat to humanity.
And a threat to humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are now threats to humanity because we do not agree with their view of, quote, reproductive rights, unquote. Let's not use the word abortion. Interestingly, we've talked about this before, I think, that the kind of polling that's used now to say that 95% of Americans believe that the Democratic Party is right and that every woman deserves an abortion. Most people are pretty uncomfortable with the idea that an abortion can take place once the moment of viability is achieved in an unborn infant. And I often put it this way to people who are decrying that somehow the Supreme Court has outlawed abortion. Well, you pointed out in your monologue that what has happened is the Supreme Court has said, we're going to take it away from 9 people and we're going to turn it back to 7,500 state legislators to argue about and work on getting it righter than not, and take into consideration views from across the political spectrum, not just one set of views. And so the use of the word abortion now has been replaced with reproductive rights, reproductive health, women's reproductive health. And the word abortion is disappearing. And yet most people would be pretty uncomfortable. And you just ask this question. So is it acceptable to abort a child 1 minute before it otherwise would have been born naturally? Well, that'd be horrific, wouldn't it? Well, now we just have a line drawing problem. Most Americans fall in that category of people going, at some point, I get the fact that there are people who would perform abortions when most of us thinks that's wrong and might even call it murder.
Yeah, 60 to 70% of Americans do not support abortion rights the way Nancy Pelosi and Elizabeth Warren describe them, because they mean partial birth abortion, and 60 to 70% of Americans don't.
That's correct. Right. And so as now they're going forward, anybody who believes that there should be any limit on abortion is inhumane, is controlling women's bodies, is interfering with their rights to reproductive health, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's just one example in the current debate of how the people with a different view on the conservative side are being dehumanized.
And thus, we're not going to enforce the law against protesting in front of the Supreme Court justices' homes, and we're not going to make an issue of the fact that there was an assassination attempt against one of these justices, right?
That's correct. That's exactly
part of that thinking.
That justice, a justice who would vote in an opinion to return to the states the power to debate this and set... They are subhumans and do not deserve police protection from mobs any more than the owners of small stores in Los Angeles or in Scottsdale deserve protection from mobs because the protesters were protesting racism.
Right.
Just don't celebrate Easter in a public park in the city of Phoenix, because that violates the mayor's sense of appropriate behavior. That's what we had just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And dehumanizing people on the right is getting increasingly obvious. It's happening with greater frequency. And its end is exactly what you're talking about. And for you and me to be sitting here talking about, folks, do you not understand that what this leads to is not just Nazi behavior, which the left wants to point the right at? It leads to totalitarian behavior that you see in the Soviet Union. It's on both extremes. And it happens from the same cause. Dehumanize the people that you want to eliminate from the conversation. And you don't just eliminate them from the conversation. You eliminate them from being present at all.
I can't improve on that. We'll come back with some concluding thoughts. Hugh, thank you. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, portions of which have been brought to you by Balance of Nature, such a great product. I take it every single day. It boosts my immunity, my health, my energy, all naturally, pure, potent plant power, 100%. You can get your access to their fruits and veggies as well by going to balanceofnature.com. That's balanceofnature.com. Make sure to use discount code BALANCE. I want to thank you, Hugh Hallman, for being my guest today, as you are every Tuesday. Something happened in liberalism. And I was talking about this in my monologue, but liberalism used to be a viewpoint that made democracy or even a constitutional republic possible, because it assumed that it didn't have all the truth on its side a priori, that it was, as learned hands said, never too sure that it was right. Hence debate, hence free speech. Hence free press, hence elections. You don't need any of that if you assume the mantle of complete righteousness politically, morally, and in every other way. Liberalism isn't liberalism anymore, Hugh.
I have decried the loss of the word liberal for its intended purpose for my lifetime, because those of us who are now deemed conservatives and by the hard left unfit to not only serve in office, but perhaps to exist, are still the font of what liberalism meant to the founding of this society, that the rule of law should be applied equally to all of us, not just the meager, but kings, that the concept that the ends justify the means is abhorrent to our society, that the way in which we do things and the process, as you mentioned earlier, by which we conduct ourselves is as important as the ends we are trying to achieve. I often have taught my sons and others who want to listen that maybe the most important lesson I knew when I served in government, but also in any role I've ever played, is it's crucially important to identify what is the right thing to do, but equally important to do it in the right way. Because if you do it in the wrong way, not only have you destroyed the concept that we exist here in this society, but you even destroy the ends you're trying to achieve. And so you must do both. Pick the ends you're seeking to achieve and understand the unintended consequences of those ends, and then make darn sure that you're doing it the correct way so that you do not destroy the very vehicle by which we can achieve anything. And the left seems hell-bent right now on destroying the vehicle that has served this society for 250 years and the concept of liberalism that brought it to bear.
Well, I'll just say what I said last week. We're going to have to create an office for you to run for, Hugh. You're just you're an incredible gift to our state and our country and to me and our audience. Thank you for that. Thank you for everything you do and are. Until tomorrow, I'm Seth Leibson. God bless you all, and class is dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.